This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. After 2 weeks of noisy protests in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker has formally unveiled his budget plan. It would slash aid to schools and local governments, as well as health care to the poor. Yesterday's budget address was delivered to a less-than-full chamber. Senate Democrats are still gone, out of state, in order to prevent a vote on a measure that would curb collective bargaining rights for most state workers. We have two reports this morning. We're going to hear from some of the senators out of state. We begin in Wisconsin with NPR's David Shaper.
Thousands of protesters stood in the cold outside the Wisconsin Capitol, their chants of recall and loud cheers ringing through the state assembly chamber as this new Republican governor and now national lightning rod for unions arrived for his first budget address.
Mr. President and members, the governor of the great state of Wisconsin, the Honorable Scott Walker.
With majority Republicans cheering loudly and Democrats grimly seated, Walker outlined a budget plan that delivers deep spending cuts to close a projected $3.6 billion deficit over the next 2 years.
The facts are clear. Wisconsin is broke, and it's time to start paying our bills today so our kids are not stuck with even bigger bills tomorrow.
Walker says it's time to end the state's reliance on budget gimmicks, federal stimulus funds, and tax hikes.
This is a reform budget. It's about getting Wisconsin working again. And to make that happen, we need a balanced budget that works.
This budget blueprint essentially reshapes state government at nearly every level, and it chops $1.5 billion from schools and local government. On top of that, Walker calls for reducing what school districts, cities, towns, and counties can raise from property taxes to offset any state cuts, a double whammy to their budgets.
Where we must make reductions, we do so wisely by giving local government the tools to save even more money than the overall reductions in state aid.
Those tools remain the main source of controversy here, the elimination of nearly all collective bargaining rights for most public employees. Miles Turner heads the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators. He says Walker's proposed changes to collective bargaining would not save nearly enough money to make up for the budget cuts and could usher in educational chaos.
Extreme impact on local classrooms, class sizes, class offerings, employee benefits. We see this as a very, very frightening time for Wisconsin public education.
But for now, everything remains stalled because the empty chairs for the governor's budget address means Senate Democrats are still absent from the Capitol. David Shaper, NPR News, Madison.
I'm Cheryl Corley, and I found a few of the Wisconsin senators who had left their undisclosed locations at a Comfort Suites hotel about 20 miles south of the Wisconsin border.
We're not staying here. We're staying other places in Illinois.
That's Democratic Senate Leader Mark Miller. He and his colleagues missed their northern home, but Miller says they've been staying in touch with constituents by email, Facebook, Twitter, and Skype. In the hallway, Senator Chris Larson gave a supporter a few dollars for a Wisconsin treat he had brought him, root beer, brewed in Milwaukee.
It's kind of tough to find.
February 17th is the last day the 14 Democrats were in Madison, protesting the governor's effort to eliminate collective bargaining rights. Larson says he's ready to go back to his home state, but he says that's up to the governor, and he's not buying Walker's argument that his absence could lead to widespread layoffs.
We take it seriously, but the fact that he's trying to pit, you know, workers against working rights is unfortunate and disgusting. At the same time as he's cutting taxes for corporations and cutting taxes for people who really don't need it. So it's really a false choice.
Senator Miller says Governor Walker did appear to be conciliatory during his budget address when calling for Democrats to come home.
We appreciate the change in tone.
But he says there is much in the governor's budget that's troubling. Miller says Democrats have offered ideas to balance the budget that Walker has ignored. Like Larson, he dismisses the governor's layoff predictions.
Well, that's just a threat, and it's bogus because, I mean, he may go through with the layoff notices and so forth and try to use us as an excuse, but we provided him on Monday with an outline.
An outline that he says shows how the state can dig out from its budget woes without the drastic measures. Senator Chris Larson says although there have been some discussions with a few Republican colleagues, there's still no agreement on when the Democrats will return.
The fact is we've only been gone for 2 weeks. You know, we're standing strong.
And apparently heartened by demonstrations that are now going into their third week. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
High energy prices haven't dented the recovery in auto sales yet. Last month, U.S. auto sales jumped more than 20% compared to February of last year. Here's NPR's Sonari Glinton with the details.
Sales for GM and Toyota each went up more than 40%. All the other car companies saw double-digit growth.
U.S. consumers love to spend.
TrueCar.com's Jesse Toprock says these days it doesn't take much to get consumers in the showrooms.
The fact that we haven't spent much in the last 2 years is a complete anomaly. And it doesn't take us much to convince to get into that shiny new car and get the new car smell.
Toprock says the last few years of relative austerity will translate into higher car sales in the near future. But will the desire for the new car smell ripple through the economy? Dean Baker with the Economic Policy Institute says good car numbers can outshine one very dark spot, construction.
And a factor making it worse is the overall demographics. And all the baby boomers, most of them are in their 50s, some already in their 60s. They're moving into smaller homes. Our population growth is much slower. It's going to take us a long, long time to whittle down this excess supply of housing.
So this is a story that's going to be with us for...
for quite some time. That's my expectation.
Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is testifying before Congress this week. He's delivering the Fed's semi-annual report about the state of the economy. We think that he is optimistic, but always when a Fed chairman speaks, it helps to find an interpreter to translate his words into English.
Which is why we brought in David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. David, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay, so what are the reasons for Bernanke's cautious optimism, if in fact that's what it is?
No, I think that's what it is. He's basically saying the economy is better, but not good. He pointed out that, for instance, the bad news is we lost nearly 9 million private sector jobs during the recession, and we've only got 1 million of them back. But we are slowly adding jobs. So although he says until we see stronger job growth, we can't consider the recovery, in his words, to be truly established, the Fed is now predicting that we'll see unemployment down below 8% by the end of next year.
By the end of next year, 2012. So still
right.
A very slow decline in unemployment here.
Absolutely. So he's pleased that the economy's growing, but he says it's not growing fast enough.
Now, at the same time, a lot of people are worried about whether the crisis in Libya, which is sparking an increase in oil prices, which were already going up, could have an effect on the economy. What's Bernanke think?
Right. That's probably the biggest change in the world economy since he was last grilled by Congress. And what he basically says is that he expects, at worst, a modest and temporary increase in inflation. Higher gasoline prices, he says, can reduce the amount of money that consumers have to spend on other things. That's bad for the economy. But they can also raise people's expectations of inflation, which is an early warning sign of inflation. So far, though, he sounds pretty calm. He says that the rise in oil prices we've seen so far don't pose what he called a significant risk to their forecast that inflation is actually so low that it's too low for their own comfort.
Is there anything in what you just said that would suggest that the Fed might have to be thinking about raising interest rates to restrain inflation?
No, the Fed is in this kind of watchful waiting mode. They keep saying that, you know, we're not on autopilot, but we don't expect anything in monetary policy to change for months and months and months. He says they won't raise interest rates and they won't start selling some of this huge hoard of securities that they have until they're convinced that the recovery is what he called self-sustaining and inflation has risen closer to their long-term goal of about 2%.
David, for some reason, I'm thinking of a U.S. diplomat more than a century ago who said that the job of a diplomat sometimes in complicated situations was the most stubborn inaction. I wonder if that's what Bernanke is holding to now, stubborn inaction.
No, I think that's right. And I think what you saw in the testimony yesterday is a number of members of the Senate Banking Committee are kind of incredulous. And they say, surely you're going to start fighting inflation, aren't you, Mr. Bernanke? After all, oil prices are up. And he's telling him, no, I'm not going to let inflation get out of control, but it isn't anywhere near that yet. So I'm staying on the sideline.
You're talking about questioning before the Senate. How might things be different as he goes before the House of Representatives?
Well, the House committee is much bigger and it has a much more diverse set of critics of the Fed, from Ron Paul, the libertarian from Texas on the right, and Barney Frank, the liberal from Massachusetts on the left. So he'll give the same speech to them, but then the question and answering, which is the real theater of a congressional hearing, is likely to be somewhat more lively and at times bizarre. But at the moment, he seems to be able to withstand this thing and enjoy like defending what the Fed's doing, because the economy's getting better And that's always easier for a Fed chairman.
Well, David, enjoy the testimony today.
Thank you.
David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal and a regular guest here.